Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this, our third History Society talk in 2017. Before we begin, could I ask you please to switch off your cell phones or put them on silent? Now, after the meeting, Ray Roberts will be selling our first occasional paper entitled Grandfather's Diary, an Irish Rhodesian Odyssey, transcribed and edited by his grandson, Dr. Duncan Clark. It has over 100 annotations by R.S. Roberts, 110 pages, 6 illustrations, and is selling for $10. Ray has also asked me to announce that he will be giving away free copies of Zimbabwean History. There are 3 volumes. And Adele Hamilton Ritchie will also be selling copies of our Heritage magazine after the meeting. Hartley Hills outing. Regretfully, our planned trip to Nyanga could not take place for various reasons, nor did the replacement to Charter Estate due to the difficulties in getting hold of the DA. Thanks to Mike Tucker and Robin Taylor, we replaced this with a trip to the very historic Hartley Hills on the 28th of May. 64 members attended, and I believe it was deemed successful and popular. As a result of this, we hope to have further outings later this year. Future talks. On July the 30th, we hope to have a talk by Marie de Brain on the diary of the Steyn trek from Craddock to Melsetta. In August, Robin Taylor will be hosting us in his garden and will be talking on the history of poultry showing in Zimbabwe, a subject on which he is an expert. And then on the 10th of September, John O. Waters will be delivering a talk entitled The Centenary of the Birth of Frederick Courtney Salu. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce today's speaker, John Dawson. I met John 54 years ago when we were both fortunate enough to attend Geoffrey Bond's geology lectures at the then University College of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. We also met outside the lecture theatre when we played hockey in the same hockey team. John was an excellent goalie, as I remember. John started his working career as a geologist and moved into the IT industry by joining IBM in 1969. Having spent several years in systems design and programming, he finished up as managing director of Unitech, IBM's Zimbabwean agent, prior to IBM's re-entry into the Zimbabwe market in 1995. At the end of 1997, he took early retirement from IBM to pursue his own business interests and currently works as an independent consultant specializing in project management. John was married to another Dawson, Anne, in 1964, and they had 2 sons, Andrew, who is an electronics engineer, and Jeremy, who sadly died in 2015, was a graphics designer. Anne sadly succumbed to breast cancer in 2012. John, who has 4 grandchildren, now lives happily with his partner, Pat Campbell. Over to John.
Thank you.
Right. Ooh. Well. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming today. You will note that whereas the notice of this talk entitled it The History of Computers, I've chosen rather to call it The History of Computing, because I think that more accurately describes the content. For those who are concerned about the possible technical nature of the talk, let me assure you that there will not be any content that could not be easily understood by a postgraduate PhD electronics student. Don't worry, just kidding. I will not be going into the technology other than to describe it in very broad terms and will focus more on what it can do and who invented it. The first, from the earliest of times when man started to own property, such as livestock, either as an individual or as a community, the need to count and calculate arose. Man started to count using his fingers. Having 10 of them meant that most early numbering systems were based on the decimal system. Once he ran out of fingers and toes and the use of pebbles or bones were substituted, archaeologists in Europe have found bones with notches cut in groups of 5, presumably to record the numbers of some or other asset. Dates vary in the literature, but the following give an indication of the progression. Circa 3000 BC, ancient Egyptians devised an early form of the abacus. Around 1000 BC, Chinese counting boards originated, and in AD 300, the Chinese began the development of the abacus as a mathematical device. In AD 500, the abacus was in use in Europe. The abacus does not do the computing. It just helps people keep track of numbers while they do the computing. John Napier was a Scottish landowner, mathematician, physicist, and astronomer. He's best known as the discoverer of logarithms and for his work on decimal notation. He also invented Napier's bones. These were graduated rods made of bone or wood, used for multiplication and division based on the principles of logarithms. An interesting fact is that John Napier's father, Sir Archibald Napier, was just 16 years old when John was born. He started young in those days. John Napier died from the effects of gout at the age of 67. Thank goodness for allopurinol today. Blaise Pascal was a French mathematician, physicist, inventor, writer, and Catholic theologian. He was a child prodigy who was educated by his father, who was a tax collector in Rouen. In 1642, at the age of 19, Pascal invented the Pascaline. The Pascaline is known as the first mechanical and automatic calculator. Pascal invented the Pascaline to help make his father's job as a tax accountant easier. The Pascaline was a wooden box that could only add and subtract by means of a series of gears and wheels. When each wheel rotated one revolution, it would then turn the neighboring wheel. On top of the wheels were a series of windows through which the totals could be read. The picture shows the inner workings of the Pascaline. It sounds in principle very like the facet machine that I'm sure many of us would have used at some stage or other. Pascal had poor health, especially after his 18th birth, after the age of 18, and he died just 2 months after his 39th birthday. Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, in 1673, perfected the Leibniz calculator. Leibniz had entered a university at 15 years of age and received his bachelor's degree at 17, so he was obviously a pretty bright fellow. The Leibniz was also a calculating machine, but much superior to that of the Pascaline. It could do more than just add and subtract. The Leibniz calculator could also multiply, divide, and find square roots of numbers. It, too, was mechanical and worked by hand. A crank was added to speed up the work of this calculator, and it was used by mathematicians and bookkeepers. The crank was also a feature of the facet machine that I referred to earlier. Joseph Marie Charles Jacquard was a French weaver and merchant. He was born into a conservative Catholic family in Lyon, France, on the 7th of July, 1752. He was one of 9 children of Jean-Charles Jacquard, a master weaver, and his wife, Antoinette Reeve. However, only Joseph and his sister Clemenceau survived to adulthood. Not a very good track record. Although his father was a man of property, Joseph received no formal schooling and remained illiterate until he was 13. He was then eventually taught by his brother-in-law, who ran a printing and bookselling business. Jacquard played an important role in the development of the earliest programmable loom, the Jacquard loom, which in turn played an important role in the development of other programmable machines, including early computers. The Jacquard loom is a mechanical loom that uses pasteboard cards with punched holes, each card corresponding to one row of the design. Multiple rows of holes are punched in the cards, and the many cards that compose the design of the textile are strung together in order. And obviously the concept of programming a device through holes in cards has come through right through to relatively recently. Charles Babbage was an English mathematician, philosopher, inventor, and mechanical engineer. In the early 1820s, he designed a computing machine called the difference engine. This machine was to be used in the calculating and printing of simple maths tables. In the 1830s, he designed a second computing machine called the analytical engine. This machine was to be used in calculating complicated problems. By following a set of instructions. However, neither of these machines were ever built because the technology at the time was not advanced enough. And both of his projects lacked financial funding. I think it was the lack of financial funding that was determinant rather than the lack of technology, because in later years, a descendant of his built the analytical engine using technology of Babbage's day, so it was really probably the lack of funding that prevented him. The computing machines made in the 1900s, and even those today, are based on the designs of the difference engine and the analytical engine. This is why Charles Babbage is known as the father of computers. On the personal front, Babbage married Georgiana Whitmore in 1814, who bore him 8 children before her death in 1827. Only 4 of his children survived to adulthood. Those were harsh times. An interesting aside, and a little bit on the ghoulish side, is that half of Babbage's brain is preserved at the Hunterian Museum in the Royal College of Surgeons in London, and the other half is on display in the Science Museum in London. I'm not sure that I particularly want to go and look at it. Ada Lovelace, Lady Lovelace, was the only legitimate child of the poet Lord Byron. All of Byron's other children were born out of wedlock to different women. Lady Lovelace was a genius in maths and was curious about Babbage's work. In some notes that she published about the analytical engine, she outlines the fundamentals of computer programming, and she has therefore been called the first computer programmer. Lady Lovelace helped Babbage with programs for the analytical engine. Many of her ideas are like those used in today's computer programs. Sadly, like Babbage, Lady Lovelace never lived to see her ideas used. She died at the age of 36. A programming language used chiefly by the US government was named Ada in her honor. Herman Hollerith was an American inventor and engineer. He invented a machine called the tabulating machine, using notes that were left by Babbage. Hollerith entered his machine in a competition held by the U.S. Census Bureau in 1889 to determine which of all available methods would be best for the next census. The Hollerith electrical tabulating system was the overwhelming winner. Prior to this invention, it took nearly 8 years to count everyone in the United States and add up all the information about where people lived, their ages, what their jobs were, etc. The tabulating machine used punch cards to record and sort data or information. And 65 cards could be passed through this computer in a minute. And in 1890, it took only 2.5 years to complete the US Census. Hollerith founded the Computing Tabulating Recording Company, or CTR, which later became IBM. a company that dominated the early years of the IT industry. The era of electromechanical accounting machines overlapped with the early computers. I count myself very privileged because due to the situation in then Rhodesia and sanctions, electromechanical accounting machines continued in use here probably well beyond their useful lives elsewhere in the world. Consequently, while my career in IT is only about 50 years duration, it spans technology over perhaps a 75-year period. When I took over management of IBM Rhodesia in 1970, Shell and BP ran their entire data processing on such machines. A data system would comprise a master file of names and addresses and punch cards kept in account number order. Each month, all transactions, invoices, credit notes, payments, etc. would be punched into cards. At the month end, these cards would be sorted on a card sorter, which looked like that. You had to pass, if you were sorting an 8-digit number, if the account number, say, was 8 digits, you had to pass the cards through that machine 8 times to get them into sequence. They would then be merged on a device called a collator and fed into a tabulator from which would print statements and such like. And then you might sort the transactions into a different sequence to produce a sales analysis on the same tabulator. These tabulators were programmed with that sort of rat's nest of wires and a plugboard panel, and you'd have to have a different panel for each application. A mathematician and physicist at Iowa State College, John Atanasoff, was looking for ways to solve equations automatically. He took a drive to clear his thoughts in 1937, and at a Mississippi River roadhouse, he jotted on a napkin the basic features of an electronic computing machine. Atanasoff's linear equation solver, built with graduate student Clifford Berry, could solve a variety of problems, but was not programmable. This became known as the Atanasoff-Berry computer, or ABC. As you can see, we're getting into our own lifetimes now. Howard Aiken was an American physicist and a pioneer in computing. In 1937, Aiken outlined a plan for a machine that could perform maths problems involving very large numbers. In 1944, IBM paid engineers to build Aiken's machine at Harvard University. Called the Mark I, it was made up of 78 adding machines and desk calculators that were connected by almost 500 miles of wire. In 1 second, the Mark I could add 3 8-digit numbers. Remember that when we get further on and see the speeds of current computers. It could output its results on punch cards or on an electric typewriter. This was the first programmable computer in America. The machine had some serious disadvantages, though. It was enormous, 51 feet long and 8 feet high. Its 3,000 electrical switches made a terrible racket as they kicked on and off, and the Mark I was expensive and complicated to build. After all, it had 1 million parts and weighed approximately 5 tons. Howard Aiken predicted that a mere 6 electronic computers would meet the computing needs of the entire United States. Alan Turing, who we've all heard of, I think, and certainly that was made famous by a recent film starring Cumberbatch, he was an English mathematician, cryptanalyst, and computer scientist. In 1936, he described the Turing machine in an article published in the Proceedings of the London Mathematical Society entitled On Computable Numbers with an Application to the Entscheidungs Problem. The Entscheidungs Problem translates from German as the decision problem and is an obscure logical challenge that I won't attempt to describe here, mainly because I couldn't. However, the concept of the Turing machine has been highly influential in the development of computers ever since. I recently read a book called Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe, which attributes much of the credit for the digital world today to Turing's insights, and he is widely considered to be the father of theoretical computer science and artificial intelligence. During World War II, the Enigma machine was developed by the Germans to enable them to encode and decode messages quickly and accurately with a high degree of complexity. They thought the code was unbreakable. Fortunately for the Allies, they were wrong. In January 1943, at Bletchley Park, Turing, along with a number of colleagues, began to construct an electronic machine to break the Enigma code. This machine, which they dubbed Colossus, comprised 1,800 vacuum tubes and was completed and working by December of the same year. Turing's work is credited with shortening the war by at least a year. Colossus was one of the world's earliest working programmable electronic digital computers. However, it was a purpose-built machine that was really only suited to a narrow range of tasks and could not be called a general-purpose computer. Sadly, after the war, Turing, who was gay, was convicted for gross indecency and agreed to chemical sterilization to avoid a prison term. He ended his life by cyanide poisoning in 1954, although some historians say it was accidental. He was recently pardoned by the British government, but I don't suppose that helped him a lot. In the era that we're currently reviewing, one of the greatest brains was John von Neumann. He was born in Budapest and proved to be a child prodigy. At 6 years old, he could multiply and divide 2 8-digit numbers in his head. He was a true polymath, that's a word I had to look up, which means a person of great learning in several fields of study. Wikipedia describes him as a mathematician, physicist, inventor, and computer scientist. In 1933, he was offered a lifetime professorship at the Princeton Institute of Advanced Studies. Beginning in the late 1930s, von Neumann was heavily involved in the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb. And it was his calculations that determined that the bomb would be more effective if detonated thousands of meters above the target, as was done at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Von Neumann's computer-based work played a huge role in the design and building of the hydrogen bomb, the fusion bomb. And he is credited with the equilibrium strategy called mutually assured destruction, which aims to keep the peace by balancing the number of nuclear weapons held by the superpowers. It is paradoxical that computer technology, with the potential to benefit mankind immeasurably, also gave birth to the technology that could destroy mankind. Many of the early computing developments after the Second World War were offshoots from research at the Institute of Advanced Studies under his professorship. He is also the originator of the concept of storing instructions and data in the same computer memory, which concept is universally implemented in all modern computers. This architecture was called the von Neumann architecture. Von Neumann died from either bone or pancreatic cancer, they don't know which, at the young age of 53. In 1943-44, two University of Pennsylvania professors, John Marchley and J. Presper Eckert, built the An Electronic Numerical Integrator and Calculator, ENIAC, considered the grandfather of digital computers. It fills a 20-foot by 40-foot room and has 18,000 vacuum tubes. That's 10 times more than the Colossus. The total cost of the ENIAC was $487,000, which equates to $6.7 million in today's money. In 1946, Marchley and Presper and Eckert left the University of Pennsylvania over a dispute when the university wanted to claim the patents that they had registered. They received funding from the Census Bureau to build the UNIVAC, the first commercial computer for business and government applications. Design work on the UNIVAC was started by a company formed by Eckert and Marchley called the Eckert Marchley Computer Corporation. This company was acquired by Remington Rand that brought the product to market. The UNIVAC used 5,000 vacuum tubes, weighed 7.3 metric tons, and could perform nearly 2,000 operations per second. The first UNIVAC was delivered to the US Census Bureau in March 1951. The fifth machine, built for the US Atomic Energy Commission, was used by CBS to predict the results of the 1952 presidential election. And with sample data from just 1% of the voting public, the machine famously predicted an Eisenhower landslide when conventional wisdom favored Adlai Stevenson. Everyone's heard of the term generations as applied to computers. All the computers we have looked at so far were based on vacuum tubes or valves. This is the first generation of computers. In 1947, three scientists, John Bardeen, William Shockley, and Walter Brattain, working at AT&T's Bell Laboratories, invented what would replace the vacuum tube forever. That invention was, of course, the transistor, made from semiconductors such as silicon. The transistor can act as a switch or an amplifier. It was faster, more reliable, smaller, and much cheaper to build than a vacuum tube. It gave off virtually no heat compared to a vacuum tube. Without this invention, space travel in the 1960s would not have been possible. The relationship between William Shockley and Bardeen and Brattain was fraught with difficulties. Shockley tried to claim patent rights for the transistor, negating the roles played by the other two. However, in 1956, the Nobel Prize for Physics was awarded jointly to all three men. The transistor shepherded in the second generation of computers. Examples of second generation computers are the IBM 1401 and the Honeywell 400. In the early 70s, I worked on a 1401 computer in IBM's offices in Livingston House. It was a purely punch card system without disk or tape. The main RAM was just 4K. Think about what you've got in your cell phones today. In 1958, Jack Kilby of Texas Instruments and Robert Noyce of Fairchild Semiconductor unveiled the integrated circuit known as the computer chip. They perfected different aspects of the integrated circuit, and both men accept the accolade of co-inventors. Robert Noyce, who was nicknamed the mayor of Silicon Valley, was the co-founder of Fairchild Semiconductor and was later a co-founder of Intel. He was an active person flying his own aircraft, hang gliding, and scuba diving. He was granted 15 patents in his lifetime, but sadly died of a heart attack at the young age of 62. Jack Kilby, in addition to the integrated circuit, invented the handheld calculator and the thermal printer, for which he held patents. He was also granted another 7 patents in the semiconductor field. Kilby was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2000 for his work. And obviously, there had been huge developments in the integrated circuit since he had invented it. So in his acceptance speech, he quoted another Nobel laureate who said it was like the beaver and the rabbit looking at the Hoover Dam. In response to a question by the rabbit, the beaver says, "I didn't build it, but it's based on an idea of mine." The integrated circuit made further miniaturization possible, and computers of this era are called third generation. Let's look at some examples of third generation computers. The IBM System 360 computers were probably the most successful of the third generation. In 1969, Salisbury City Council, then Salisbury, installed a System 360 Model 30 computer, which I worked on from time to time. It had 16K of memory and 21 megabytes of disk storage. Another third generation computer, oh, by the way, the city treasurer in those days was Ian Gallifrey, who used to be a very active member of this society. Another third generation computer was the ICL 2900 series. ICL was the British computer maker that later became part of Fujitsu. They were one of the most successful computer vendors in Zimbabwe and sold many 2900s in this country. The Century series was NCR's third generation computer. NCR also did well here, and the Treasury Computer Bureau was an early NCR customer. The terms mainframe, mid-range, and mini-computer came into use at this time. The HP 3000 was an early example of a mini-computer. Hewlett-Packard's advertising tended to be rather prosaic, leading one commentator to say, if HP had invented sushi, they would have called it cold, wet, dead fish. The next significant development in the computer field was the introduction of the microprocessor. The first commercial microprocessor was Intel 4004 in 1971. Federico Fagan, an Italian-born American, led the 404 design team during the first 5 years of Intel's microprocessor effort. Marcion Ted Hoff is credited with coming up with the concept of the microprocessor, also called the computer on a chip, and Stanley Mazor and Masatoshi Shima were also members of the team that developed that. And interesting now to see that these people are all still alive, whereas most of the people we've looked at before have passed on. And so this is now the fourth generation of computers based on microprocessors. And virtually all computers since then have been developed using microprocessors, and the power and size of the capacity of these microprocessors has just developed exponentially over the years. The advent of the microprocessor gave rise to the home computer market. Some of the developments in the personal computer space have been, in 1974, Altair released one of the first hobbyist home computers, closely followed by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak releasing the first Apple computer, and then Radio Shack's TRS-80. In 1978, the first spreadsheet program, VisiCalc, was released, being the forerunner to Lotus 1-3 and Excel. The first word processing program, WordStar, came out the following year, and I doubt if there's anyone here today who hasn't used some form or other of word processing software. Perhaps the most defining event in the PC marketplace was IBM's entry into the market in 1981 with the first IBM personal computer. An amusing story, which may or may not be apocryphal, was that when IBM decided to enter the PC market, they needed an operating system on which their product would run. There were two contenders, the Control Program for Microcomputers, or CPM, and the Disk Operating System, DOS, from a small Silicon Valley startup called Microsoft. The story has it that when IBM tried to contact the CPM guys, they were taking a summer break and surfing on the coast, and so IBM then went to their second choice, Microsoft, and the rest is history. In 1985, Microsoft introduced its Windows operating system in response to an earlier innovation by Apple, providing a mouse-based graphical user interface. In 1990, an English engineer and computer scientist, Tim Berners-Lee, working at CERN, that's the high-speed particle accelerator in Switzerland, invented a language called Hypertext Transfer Protocol, or HTTP. And if you didn't know what it stood for, I'm sure you've all seen the letters on your browsers, which is the foundation of data communication on the internet and has enabled the formation of the World Wide Web. The birth of the internet is the single biggest factor in influencing the modern world, both for good and ill. In 1993, Intel introduced the Pentium chip, a major step forward in microprocessor power. In 1996, Google was launched. In 2004, Facebook came online, and 2005, the video streaming site YouTube was implemented. 2007, Steve Jobs launched the iPhone, followed by the iPad in 2010. At the other end of the scale, we have supercomputers. The fastest supercomputer in the world is the Sunway Taihu Light in China. It can perform, and I will explain this a bit further, it can perform 93 petaflops. That means 93 quadrillion floating point operations per second. I'll just show you some of the prefixes that attain. You've all heard of kilo and mega, and probably giga. You've heard of kilobytes, megabytes, gigabytes. Tera, you're starting to get terabytes even at the PC level now. And peta is, so you've got thousand, million, billion, trillion, quadrillion. It's just mind-blowing. The second most powerful supercomputer in the world is the Tianhe 2, which is also a Chinese. It's in the National Computer Center in Guangzhou. It was developed by a team of 1,300 scientists and engineers. Titan is a supercomputer built by an American company called Cray that has always specialized in building supercomputers. It is situated at Oak Ridge National Laboratory for use in a variety of science projects, but that only clocks in at 17.6 petaflops. After I prepared this talk, I learned that another Chinese supercomputer had overtaken the Titan, which means that the top three supercomputers in the world are now Chinese. I find that vaguely disturbing. This shows how performance has developed over the years. The center graph, and these are roughly straight lines, because this is a logarithmic scale. It goes up 10 times at each interval. So if you plotted these, they would go like that on a non-logarithmic scale. So that's the most powerful supercomputer in the world, currently at 93 petaflops. The least powerful is down here, 286 at teraflops. And then 567 is the aggregate of the top 500 supercomputers, the computing power of the top 500 supercomputers. Gordon Moore, who co-founded Intel with Robert Noyce in 1968, formulated the so-called Moore's Law. When he observed the density of transistors on early integrated circuits was doubling every year. He later revised that to approximately every 2 years. Obviously, Moore's Law has served him pretty well, as his net worth is listed in Forbes magazine as 7.1 billion. This graph is also on a logarithmic scale. As you can see, the number of transistors per chip is around the billion mark now, heading for the 10 billion mark. And the performance of these chips has increased in a similar ratio. The process technology at the top of the graph there is showing the size of the, in nanometers, of the, that's the size in microns. And there is 100 nanometers. We're currently at 45 nanometers, heading for 10 nanometers. To put it in perspective, a nanometer, a silicon atom, is about 2 nanometers in size. So we're getting down to near atomic size now with this type of technology. So, in fact, they're already working on 14 nanometers and 32 nanometers. So 45 is not the very latest. And if you can, so we're going to bump up very soon against the molecular size being the limiting factor of the current technology. You can't have connections between transistors less than a molecule wide. And so I'll talk more about that later on, at the very end. What are the applications of supercomputers? Pretty much anything, but mainly they're used a lot for weather forecasting, which is one of the most complex analyses that can be done. Simulation of nuclear weapons. You can now conduct nuclear tests without actually detonating a bomb. Molecular modeling, code breaking, modeling the universe, designing new drugs, auto crash simulation, are just some of the applications of supercomputers. I'd love to know what the Chinese are doing with their 3D. So to get an idea of how computing power has progressed over the years, the IBM System 360 Model 30 computer that I worked on at Townhouse could do 34,500 instructions per second. That was developed in the early 1960s. The Apollo guidance computer was about 2.5 times faster than that. By comparison, an Apple iPhone 7 is 8.7 million times faster than the Model 30, and the Chinese supercomputer is 2.7 trillion times faster than that Model 30. So it really is something else. Looking now at the internet, which does, I believe, has completely rewired the world, certainly rewired a lot of children's minds. The top internet companies by revenue, Jeff Bezos founded Amazon in 1994, which was originally pretty much an online bookshop, but has developed into the largest online retailer with sales of $136 billion. Alphabet, which is the sort of holding company of Google, which was formed in 1998 by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who were both PhD students at Harvard University in California. It started as a search engine but has diversified into various internet-related services and products as well as hardware. The online video website YouTube is also part of the Alphabet Group. Facebook, I'm sure, needs no introduction, founded in 2004 by Mark Zuckerberg with several fellow Harvard students. I hate Facebook, by the way. The next two are the Chinese equivalents of Amazon and Facebook, Tencent and Alibaba. Priceline helps users obtain discount rates for travel-related purchases such as airline tickets and hotel stays. Baidu is a Chinese search engine. eBay is an online auction site. And Netflix offers video on demand. Expedia is another online travel company. If you look now at market capitalization, the Alphabet has a market capitalization of $634 billion. So we're not far off getting to companies of $1 trillion market capitalization. But if you look at the overall largest market capitalizations, Apple at $761 billion is the only company that's bigger than Google, and Microsoft comes third. So in the top five, there are five technology companies in the top 10 overall market capitalization. So, to conclude, this iPhone, which I took the precaution of switching off at the beginning, is an incredible device. This isn't even the latest one, this is an iPhone 6. But just to wrap it up, just to look at some of the fantastic things, to me they're fantastic, that I can do with that phone. I've got an app on here called Flight Radar 24. It allows me to check on the position, flight path, speed and altitude of any commercial flight anywhere in the world. For example, when I took the screenshot which we're viewing here, the red aircraft in the middle of the screen is Kenya Airways flight KQ763, just entering Zimbabwe airspace to overfly Harare en route to Nairobi. This is an app that's close to my heart. You can take a photograph of a wine label, and it will then tell you the origin of the wine and give you its rating. I have a pair of very expensive hearing aids, which I thought I'd lost one of them the other day. So I have an app on the phone which allows my incoming calls to come straight into my ears, which is fantastic. And there's a whole lot of other things. I can change the settings for restaurant or bar or whatever. And I can also use this to track my phone. So if I drop one while I was out walking, provided I've got my phone with me, and I realise when I get home that it's missing, it'll give me a map and show me exactly where I was when I last communicated with the hearing aid. And this stood me in good stead the other day because I was on a trip to Kariba, and on the way, on the last day, I couldn't find one of my hearing aids. And I'm talking about 3K each side. So I returned the cabin upside down, lifted the beds up, pulled the lockers out, and there was just no sign of it. At that point, I hadn't remembered about this, the app. But when we got in the car, I suddenly remembered. So I switched the app on, and blow me down, both hearing aids were there, somewhere near. And when we got to Saucy Sue's to get a hamburger or whatever, when I walked away from the car, the one disappeared. And when I walked back to the car, it came up again. So we knew it was somewhere in the car. And when we got back, we found that my friend Mike Whedon had inadvertently, picking up the cables for his laptop, had put it in his bag, and it obviously hooked the hearing aid into his bag. So that was Meteo Blue is a weather app that I can look at the satellite pictures and forecasts for any place in the world. The Maps app, which I'm sure many of you will have used, will give me guidance on where I am, search for where I want to go to. It'll then tell me the quickest routes and alternative routes to get there. And if I want to, it'll even give me like a Garmin type sat nav. It'll tell me turn left at the next intersection and so on. You can get it. I haven't got this particular app, but you can get an app where if you're out in the night sky, you can point your camera at the constellations, and it'll tell you what's what of those constellations. And finally, Google Earth, which I'm sure many of you will have used. Again, you can go and look at anything anywhere in the world, at various heights. This is me looking at Sanyati Gorge in the on Lake Kariba. So that's just a few of the amazing things that can be done. Sorry, I don't want to do that just yet. So, as I mentioned earlier, we will soon run into molecular size limiting current integrated circuit technology. Therefore, a whole new paradigm of computing technology is necessary. This will probably be quantum computing, based on the principles of quantum mechanics. Quantum computers use atomic and subatomic particles to store and manipulate data. Now, they do this, and I'm very reluctant to talk in front of Francis Podmore, but they use things like entanglement and superposition, which I don't begin to understand, in order to actually store information and manipulate it. But that's supposedly going to be the next major advance. And some people, a 30-qubit quantum computer would equal the processing power of a conventional computer that could run at 10 teraflops, trillions of calculations per second. Now, a 30-qubit quantum computer is just an experimental small thing at the moment. And they say that there are all sorts of simulations and problems that will never be possible on current technology computers, which quantum computers will be able to solve. So, I wouldn't add, so the concept of quantum computers was brought up by a guy called Paul Benioff. This is him in his younger days. I think he's quite a lot older than that now. But nevertheless, if quantum computers become a reality, I would predict that Paul Benioff will be given a Nobel Prize for that. So that's where we've been, where we're going, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, John. Can you hear me? Before we go to questions, which John said he will take, I must say one thing. Seeing you talk about the Hollerith department brought back really great memories for me in the 1960s. When Zisco, with about 5,500 employees, had a very big Hollerith department. Now, those were undoubtedly the bad old misogynistic days when I think the HR manager and the computer manager used to have one of the main criteria was a beauty test. And if you were very lucky and you knew the computer manager, he would take you on a tour of Hollerith. And I think all the most beautiful girls in Zisco worked in the Hollerith department. Right now, John, some questions.
Ray? Can you design an app to tell us where these roadblocks are?
The question was, can we design an app to tell us where police roadblocks are? I'm sure you could. We could probably put a geostationary satellite above Harare, but it might be a tad costly. There is, of course, as you know, a WhatsApp group that you can get onto, but apparently it's more trouble than it's worth because it's pinging every few seconds telling you where somebody else has seen a roadblock. Yes?
Meg?
Yeah, that's a very fair comment. The Ada Lovelace was the only female in the entire presentation.
One of the only things Lord Byron got right.
Yeah. I presume the first quantum computer would be called Quark Number One.
Any other questions?
John, you see at the top you've got the binary numbers.
Yes.
When did those stop and you about the computers? I know it's positive and negative. When did they use the binary numbering?
Well, the binary numbering system is the only absolutely precise way that electrically or electronically you can represent numbers, because it's unambiguous. If you were basing it on a voltage level to count from 1 to 10, there could be a bit of ambiguity if the voltage was a little too low or whatever. So and that would be called an analog computer, by the way, where numbers are represented by an analogous state. But digital computing, which is what this has been all about today, is based on the binary system, because electricity only has two figures, not 10 figures.
Yes.
Like Zessa. Yeah. Zessa is definitely binary.
Question over there, John.
John, can you give us any information on the creation of bitcoins? I believe it's electronically done at very high speeds, especially made from here in China, and it's a bit of a puzzle. Do you have any computing information on that?
Bitcoin is a very contentious product. It was in the early days, you acquired bitcoins, you mined bitcoins by solving mathematical problems. And my problem with it is you're not really adding, you're creating something out of nothing. It doesn't have any substance to back it. It's become a fairly extensively used coinage currency, but it's very unstable. Prices shoot all over the place. I can't see that these cryptocurrencies, as they call them, are ever going to replace real money.
Do you think altcoins are going to be better off than bitcoins, or is it really just the same reliance?
I haven't even heard of those. What are they called?
Altcoins? Sort of alternative currencies.
Altcoins?
Alt, yeah.
Hmm. I would imagine it'd be something similar to bitcoins, I don't know. But of course, we probably in this country have a lot of money that doesn't really exist. Computing in Zimbabwe.
The industry, because you know those big icons, NCR, ICL, IBM, they've all kind of given way to, even Microsoft had a big presence here sort of 20 years ago, there was an established office, and it seems to be quite fragmented and,
I think there's a tendency for most of the large computer corporations to operate through agents in smaller countries. So that's really what's happened here. ICL, I think, are still around, aren't they? NCR certainly are. IBM are represented by another company, and the same with Microsoft. But I think the state of computing in Zimbabwe is nothing to be ashamed of. A lot of, we do everything on a much smaller scale than elsewhere in the world, but we have got some pretty sophisticated usage of computers.
Question over there, John.
Bangalore in India seems to be the future success story to watch. What is their secret in developing such a piece of industry? What do they have and we don't have? Why couldn't we have something similar here?
we wouldn't obviously be able to operate on the same scale as the Indians can. But absolutely, there's no reason at all why, you know, we've got a lot of very bright guys that I work with in this country, and there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't develop software products that would succeed elsewhere in the world. Perhaps the limiting factor would be the investment needed to make that happen. I don't really know. I don't know what the Indians have got a very well-educated upper tier of people, although they've also got a very, very seriously stratified society. But the top people who are well-educated and very efficient. I've worked with a number of Bangalore consultants who've come out here on two or three different projects, and I found them excellent. The only thing that ever threw me was that I couldn't understand why they kept disagreeing with everything I said, until I realized that in India, this means yes, it doesn't mean no. Proprietary operating systems were the norm in the sort of early third generation days, and obviously that meant that you didn't have much interchangeability between different platforms. It also meant that you tended to lock customers in, because once they were committed to a particular operating system, it wasn't easy for them to move their entire operations onto a different operating system. And I think that then gave rise to, first to Unix, which was an open operating system and it could be developed to run on any computer. And Linux, of course, which is the PC version of Unix. And these are now becoming the, you know, most of the operating systems like on the iPhone are based on a Unix or Linux core, although they have obviously been got their own additions for specific purposes. So I think the move has been away from proprietary operating systems to non-proprietary operating systems.
Right, John, there's one question I'd like to ask. Google Maps and Google Earth, we can access everything from them, I assume, for free. Who actually funds that? How is it paid for that we get that access to this wonderful facility?
Well, Google, I think, just generally want the whole world to get onto their platforms. There will be a certain amount of advertising involved. And then also, what a lot of these applications do is that they whet your appetite by giving you a free version, but then if you want a much more detailed version, you've got to pay for it. So the people paying for the detailed version, I suppose, are funding the free version.
Thanks. My one final thing I wanted to do was add another dimension to Bletchley Park. My uncle happened to work there during the war, and I knew he wasn't a code breaker. Eventually it dawned on me that he was in MI5, and they had their spies there keeping tabs on the code breakers, which, when you think about it, was quite a sensible thing to do, because obviously they could be leaking what they were doing there. Right, finally, I'll call upon Jim Holland, himself, I think, computer expert, to give our thanks to John, to give him a small token of our appreciation.
What a fascinating talk that was.
Thank you,
John. I really enjoyed that as a computing person myself. And I hope, you know, even those who don't use, aren't involved in the industry, also found it as interesting as I did. Up here? Is this? Okay, upside. Okay. Right from the very first slide of the abacus, I felt at home, because I remember years ago visiting Hong Kong and buying an abacus and learning how to do addition and subtraction, but I was never any good at doing multiplication and division. Another one that came up to my mind was talking about the Science Museum in London. I visited that in the 1990s. In the 1990s. I didn't see Babbage's brain. Unfortunately. But the exhibition was all the very old technology at the time, and that made it really fascinating. And I remember in particular a hard disk, which was 10 megabytes in size, and it was about as big as a washing machine. Mm-hmm. So things really changed quite dramatically. And Charles, your mention of Bletchley Park brings to mind a possible connection from my youth. The housemaster at the school that I went to in England, a guy called Fred Manistee, was a mathematics expert. And we knew that he did something very secret during the war. And years later, I always suspected that that was in fact where he must have worked, because it really fitted into his absolute focus on mathematics. He was not a people person at all. It was mathematics and train timetables, which is a particular fascination. And he would know all the timetables of trains all over England. It was quite amazing. Facebook, yes, I totally agree with you on that one, John. I have a Facebook account, and I think my profile says, "Do not ask to be my friend." I never post anything there at all. I just use it so that I can see what other members of my family are up to themselves. That's my solace for Facebook. And then later on, you talked about an app on your smartphone. Talking about being able to monitor Kenya Airlines. Well, this afternoon I'm catching a plane, Kenya Airlines, to Nairobi, so maybe you'll be able to follow my flights as well. It is really incredible. But I must say that for myself, I haven't yet graduated to that stage. When I attend computing functions and bring out my old phone, I'm afraid everybody laughs, because I still haven't graduated to the stage of having a smartphone. I mean, really, I think it's because I sit in front of a computer all day and have another one in my pocket when I'm on the move. I haven't yet graduated to. Finally, there's one thing I will disagree with you on, John, and that is cryptocurrency. I really think that that is the way things are going to go, and I think it's going to be countries like the United States that are going to bring that in, because one of the problems of cash is that it can be used by criminals and it can be used by terrorists, and there's no control over flows of cash. Whereas once you move to cryptocurrencies and blockchains, then it's another world altogether. Everything can be traced. And I think that's exactly what governments like the United States will want to see happen, and I'm sure that's where it's going to go, but we can take some bets on that, I guess. And I guess that also brings the scary thing about the future is going to be the end of privacy. I just don't see how we're going to have privacy in the future, because we walk around with smartphones, the networks will know where we are, the security agencies will therefore know where we are, what we're doing, everything's going to be monitored. It's going to be another world altogether. But finally, John, thank you so much indeed for such an interesting talk. I really appreciated it, and I'm sure everybody else here in the room did as well. So thank you. Thank you.
I totally agree with Jim about the secrecy of Bletchley Park, because it was only 30 years after the end of the Second World War in 1975 that the Daily Telegraph published this headline article, Bletchley Park. And on the front page of the Telegraph was a picture of hut number 6, which wasn't the code-breaking hut, which I think was hut number 3, was a picture of my Uncle Guy. And that's how it came out. And we never knew what he did, either before or after that, so that was the clue.
John, thank you again. This is from the History Society. I hope you find the books of interest.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance. Adele will be selling Heritage magazines, and Professor Ray Roberts will be selling those books I mentioned before. Please give what you can, you feel you can afford to Stan or Bob, who will have a collection box at the doors. Thank you very much.